headlines, the deepening row over fishing waters. Britain says it reserves the right to respond to France's seizure of a British trawler one day after London summoned the French envoy. Sudanese anti-coup protesters press ahead with a civil disobedience campaign. Security forces have killed at least 8 people since the Monday coup. And the number of coronavirus-related deaths in Iran keeps declining as the country speeds up its nationwide vaccination drive. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A dispute worsening between France and the UK over post-Brexit fishing rights. The UK, angry over France's seizure of a British trawler in French waters, says it reserves the right to respond in a proportionate way. The Environment Secretary, George Eustis, says it's always possible for Britain to increase its required measures on French vessels. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued warning to another in its waters. Paris said the detained boat lacked proper license and its captain will face trial next August. Paris did so in retaliation for London denying fishing licenses to EU boats, including the French ones, operating in British waters. Paris has threatened more retaliatory measures starting from next week if talks don't progress. Britain has called the threats unjustified and summoned the French ambassador for explanations. James Tweedy is a journalist and commentator who joins us. So who's right here? Is France in the right or the UK?
This is an issue which is, let's say, very symbolic in French politics, but France is, I think, making a mountain out of a molehill, and its threats are very disproportionate. I mean, what we're talking about here is, the other day, it was only about 2 days ago, it was 35 boats, and now it seems to have gone up to 55. We're talking about small fishing boats applying for rights to fish in the territorial waters around Jersey, one of the Channel Islands. These are not strictly part of the UK, they're crown dependencies, but they're basically British territory, close to the northern French coast. And there are part of the agreement that was made between Britain and the EU when we left the EU was that boats that had traditionally fished in those waters would be allowed to during this kind of 5-year sunset clause period after we've left the bloc. And the British government is saying that, okay, there's these 55 applications and there's no record of these boats ever fishing there before. Okay, so, all right. But other than that, Britain has granted licenses to about 1,700 boats from the EU, which is 98% of the ones that have applied, and 750 of those, almost half of those, are French boats. So the French have done all right around this, you know, out of this, because you know, when we were in the EU, we were part of something called the Common Fisheries Policy. So all the fishing boats from all the 27 nations at the time could fish in each other's waters, 28 I think, could fish in each other's waters as much as they want. So boats from Greece or Cyprus could sail up the Mediterranean around and into British waters and catch fish in our exclusive economic zone, right? Now, in Iran, I think you know about exclusive economic zones because you've got one that extends out into the Persian Gulf, and its end is where that of Qatar and Bahrain and so on begin, and you have valuable mineral resources underneath the seabed there. So, okay, Britain's economic zone, exclusive economic zone, is very large because Britain is an island with little archipelagos of islands attached to it. And, the French fishing vessels were making a lot of, you know, they were doing a good business with this, and okay, now it's over, the party's over. Okay. But, you know, for the next 5 years, they can continue to fish, and then things will be reviewed. But, okay, some livelihoods are being lost. Now, in the overall scheme of the French economy, it's not very big. In the overall scheme of the European economy, the EU's economy, it's almost nothing, because what's really important overall, let's say, is things like exports of manufactured goods, largely from Germany, but also from France. They make a lot of cars. But, you know, so France is now talking tough. It's saying it's going to stop British boats from landing in French ports. It's going to try and snarl up trade between Britain and the EU, and it's essentially unilaterally saying it's going to tear up the trade and cooperation agreement which we signed when we left the EU. And this is the thing that the EU has ironically been accusing Britain of doing with Northern Ireland, but seeking to invoke one of the Article 16 of that agreement. Okay. And also they're threatening to cut off supplies of electricity to Jersey, because Jersey buys a lot of electricity from France, which generates it from nukes, which it gets from its former colonies or its neo-colonies in Africa. It gets the uranium from there. And it also sells that energy to mainland Britain. It's saying, well, we're going to cut that off, and maybe we're going to have terrible energy crisis this Christmas, you know, this winter. So, you know, it's all a big thing, but it's all escalating very quickly. But whether they really want to jeopardize the trade and cooperation agreement is another question, and whether other countries in the EU, especially Germany, will want that to happen is questionable. And they might, you know, it's been said that the European Commission is supporting France, but when you look into it, it's the French appointee to the European Commission who is predictably supporting his own country. So let's see how this one plays out.
Well, let me ask you this. You have all these inflammatory remarks that are being thrown about here and there, and threats, et cetera. And yet you have this meeting that's planned for the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the French President Emmanuel Macron to be held in Rome. So if you were, who would you like to be? And what would you like to say to the other?
Well, I don't know. Macron is going to keep making his demands, I suppose. And Boris Johnson is going to say that, since it's British waters, it's up to them. What I would say is that the trade deal was made. The trade and cooperation agreement was signed because it became a very important thing in the post-Brexit negotiation because of the concerns of a lot of people in British business, and the Northern Ireland Protocol part of it as well. That was very much about the politics in Northern Ireland and the historic, you know, the peace process of things that goes back decades. And so all of this stuff was put on, all this pressure was put on the government for this, and also from people who opposed leaving the EU in the first place. But it does appear, it does start to look like, as I've said before, that the only real Brexit was a no-deal Brexit. And then signing that trade agreement with all the conditions that came with it was quite possibly an error, and it's having repercussions, which are going to keep going. I mean, this is going to keep going for another 5 years, honestly. It's probably going to be an annual dispute where France, lots of French boats apply for licenses to fish around the Channel Islands, and the UK says, well, no, you've never fished here, so go away. France, then the French government makes this kind of threat again. So this is going to keep going for another 5 years. I don't think the two leaders, the Prime Minister and the President speaking at the G20, having a one-to-one at the G20 is necessarily going to resolve it. You know, it's not a major issue in the French economy. What it is, it's a major political issue,
right?
And it's about winning elections up in the northwest of the country.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, James Sweetie. Journalist and commentator there from Plymouth.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Okay, moving on to Sudan, anti-coup demonstrations shows no signs of abating there. Protesters are determined to press ahead with a campaign of civil disobedience against the military takeover. Capital Khartoum is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday, following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. Parliament and soldiers from the army have been deployed to Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. The UN has called on the Sudanese military to show restraint.
I want to reaffirm my strong condemnation of the coup and the need to reestablish the transition system that was in place. And tomorrow there is a manifestation that is announced. I urge the military to show restraint and not to create any more victims.
Sudan had been ruled by a joint civilian-military council since August 2019. On Monday, the military led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan dissolved the power-sharing government and declared a state of emergency. Several top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, were detained. Hamdok was later released under close guard. The country has been the scene of anti-coup rallies since the military takeover. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured. International bodies have reacted to the coup. The UN Security Council has urged the military to restore the civilian-led government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country. The African Union has also suspended Sudan's membership.
I want to...
Julius Maluto is a radio host and political analyst who joins us. We're looking at what has been announced to be a million-man march for tomorrow. What do you think is going to come out of that? Will it make a difference?
If I just stand on the ground of Sudan, just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups. They just don't want it anymore. And I can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened. We are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back, and definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby Sudanese are not relenting. They'll never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve. Otherwise, you know, this military rule is suffocating and is not good for any country. And you know what? It's about time, because pressure, you ask the patient whether this is going to make a difference, because the protests are coming at the back of all this worldwide united stance. Africa Union ban, you know, kicking out Sudan out of the Africa Union, European Union, every other big power, US as well, totally not in agreement with them, and they are just boxed. They just need to back off, and they just need to go to drawing board. Allow this transitional government to have a chance, and allow Sudanese to have a democratic rule, which is what they've been yearning for so long.
Do you think in any shape or form you're having the General Burhan to act the way he has in terms of him being steadfast about this transition not to take place right now, because he is being backed by, the, as they call it, the Troika, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt?
He's still a very lonely man, and yes, with any form of support, he's bound to be a bit an extremist in some ways. For example, when you see him coming around and, you know, recalling all the ambassadors who supported the idea that the coup was a wrong thing to do, you definitely, he's already on the defensive. You're already seeing him, what he's trying to do. And therefore, if you were to find a situation whereby he's got a backing of any country or any force, or even within the Arab League, probably then you will have some more energy to go on. But, you know, when it comes to practical governance of a country, it's not easy when your country has been so isolated, so boxed, like, okay, fine, even help from the international community not coming, and all these other things. Definitely, whether he likes it or not, you will feel the impact of lack of support from the Western countries, from the United Nations, from African Union. You definitely understand those are powers to reckon with. So this support he's enjoying right now, it's not, it's support, but I don't think it's support that would be sustainable. But probably then, of course, even these other countries that may be some sympathetic to his regime, they may realize that democracy is better than dictatorship, and Sudan has the right, for once, just to enjoy democratic rule, which they have never You know, these years, over 30 years under Omar Bashir, military takeover, before that, 17 coups. You know, if I'm a Sudanese on the ground, I would be definitely fed up. I would never want to see military trying to govern. See, the essence of military is to defend the country from external attack, and it's not just, and even if there was problems within the political arrangement democratically, they are there as a buffer to protect the country, and as while it's taking shape, when new governance is forming, that's where they are there for. But to begin to participate in politics is a vicious circle that will never end. Military takeovers always begets military takeovers most of the time, which is a catastrophe. And that's what Sudanese want to see ending.
Thank you for that. Julius Maluto, radio host and political analyst from London. Many thanks. The number of COVID-19-related deaths in Iran, meanwhile, is decreasing as the vaccination process is accelerating across the country. According to the health ministry records on Friday, 123 people lost their lives in the past day. This brings the total number of coronavirus deaths to nearly 126,000. Some 10,000 people have also tested positive in the same period. Health officials say more than 85 million doses of the COVID vaccine have been administered, and the process is accelerating. Authorities have warned that ignoring health protocols could lead to another peak of the disease. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Recordings from a 2019 panel discussion of the U.S. Council for National Policy revealed that former U.S. President Donald Trump's tax cuts for the rich were sparked by personal conversations. We'll prepare for you an article written by Jason Wilson. The piece is titled, How a Secretive Conservative Group Influenced Trump's Tax Cuts. Documents and recordings obtained by The Guardian shed new light on a powerful and secretive right-wing network and the influence it was able to exert on former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration and policies favoring the super-rich. The recordings include speeches given to the Council for National Policy, or CNP, by conservative media stars including Dennis Prager, emerging Republican power players such as Charlie Kirk, and close economic advisors to Donald Trump. Some of the previously published recordings appear to no longer be publicly available. The Guardian's independently sourced recordings offer an insight into how conservative economic thinkers from bodies representing the interests of some of the richest individuals in the country were able to exert influence on the supposed populist Donald Trump. In particular, a panel discussion at the Council for National Policy, CNP's February 2019 meeting suggests that Donald Trump decided one of his most far-reaching economic policies on very limited evidence, on the basis of a personal conversation. The panel involved Bill Walton, president of the Council for National Policy, CNP. The Washington Times columnist and former member of the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, Richard Rahn. Jonathan Williams, chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Stephen Moore, a one-time Donald Trump nominee for the Federal Reserve Board, whose nomination was withdrawn following revelations that he had failed to pay his ex-wife hundreds of thousands of dollars in alimony. The panelists offered a favorable assessment of the Trump administration's economic performance, but also used the platform to claim credit for pushing the Trump administration in the direction of radical free market policies. Stephen Moore claimed that he, together with Larry Kudlow, Donald Trump's director of the National Economic Council from 2018, had persuaded the then-president Donald Trump to offer unprecedented corporate tax cuts. He described a meeting with Trump where they argued that the United States' corporate tax rate relative to those among certain Asian and European competitors was effectively a penalty on U.S. companies, stating, "Look, you know, we're at 40%, they are 20%. This is a big problem." Stephen Moore said that they explained these tax differences using charts because Donald Trump likes to look at pictures he doesn't like to read. According to Stephen Moore, Trump looked at this and he said, "No, I don't want to do that. Instead, proposing not 20%, I want 15%. With the number coming back to an effective 20% rate only after Senate negotiations." Donald Trump's tax cuts slashed effective corporate tax rates in half, while providing other measures benefiting wealthy corporations. According to business reporters and economists, the cuts have been blamed for widening inequality in America and worsening deficits, with a large amount of the savings going to stock buybacks. The Congressional Research Service pointed out that any positive effects like the wage or gross domestic product growth were transient and had petered out by the end of the quarter in which the cuts were put into effect. This reveals the power of the Council for National Policy, the CNP, a little-known body whose members are deeply secretive about their meetings. The CNP attendees' access to this picture of the inner workings of the Trump administration and the players who helped set its course is the result of adherence to a strict code of silence. In introducing the panel, The Council for National Policy Conference Director, Mary Margaret Hathaway, enjoined participants to secrecy, reminding them to not record any speaker remarks. Hathaway said, "CNP meetings are off-limit to the press, so please be aware of who you're talking to." She added, "Don't grant any interviews if you can run into a reporter asking questions about the event. Please let a member of the Council for National Policy staff or leadership team know." Despite her warnings, the organization itself made the recordings obtained by The Guardian and uploaded them on their website in a manner that made them accessible to any internet user. Other recordings obtained by The Guardian include talks at 2018 and 2019 meetings by senior Republicans, including Senator Tom Cotton and the U.S. Congressman Steve Scalise. The former governors, including Scott Walker and Sam Brownback. The Council for National Policy, CNP, was founded in 1981 by influential Christian right activists, including Tim LaHaye, Howard Phillips, Paul Weyrich, who were also involved in founding and leading the Moral Majority. Initially, they were seeking to maximize their influence on the new Ronald Reagan administration. In the subsequent years, the Council for National Policy, CNP, meetings played host to presidential aspirants like George W. Bush in 1999 and Mitt Romney in 2007, and sitting presidents including Donald Trump in 2020. Furthermore, on the other hand, the Trump administration and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, have been charged with a sweeping and audacious illegal payment scheme of tax-related crimes, marking the first criminal charges against the former president's company following a years-long investigation by the New York prosecutors. Weisselberg, who had worked for the Trump family for nearly 50 years, surrendered to the authorities at the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse recently and was charged by the Manhattan District Attorney with failing to properly report company perks, including rent-free apartments, school fees, and cars, in the latest stage of an escalating battle between New York prosecutors and the former president. The 15-count indictment against Alan Weisselberg and the Trump Organization charged them with a scheme to defraud, grand larceny, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying business records. According to prosecutors, the Trump Organization paid employees rent, utility bills, garage fees, school expenses, and other living expenses without properly declaring them so that they could and did pay federal, state, and local taxes in amounts that were significantly less than the amounts that should have been paid. Kerry Dunn, general counsel for the Manhattan District Attorney, said the 15-year-long arrangement was a sweeping and audacious illegal payment scheme. According to prosecutors, and Weisselberg was one of the largest individual beneficiaries of the scheme. The system was orchestrated by the most senior executives at the Trump Organization. According to the prosecutors, Alan Weisselberg received $1.7 million in illegal payments, including rent, bills, and garage fees for his Manhattan apartment, and tuition expenses for Weisselberg's family members. Weisselberg and a lawyer for the Trump Organization pleaded not guilty.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I am your humble, hopefully favorite host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have two brothers in faith and humanity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, you guys. Would you do a brief introduction?
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
I'm Hassanain.
From the UK.
From India.
So today, first of all, thank you so much, you guys. So, Brother Hassanain, what's your definition of elites?
You know, elites, what I understand is, you know, the big, big political people, or the powerful people, you know, what today's world consider as, you know, the political figures, as we call, like, the big shot people, business tycoons.
So people with influence, you'd consider them as elites?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say those people who have a significant amount of influence. Because it's not necessarily those who you can see. Sometimes there are people behind the scenes who are working. I'm not even talking about politics. There are people who in certain communities, for example, you know this uncle, you know that auntie, and they're actually the elites of the community.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know them, perhaps, but yeah.
A select group that is superior in terms of ability or qualities to the rest of a group or society, or a size of letter in typewriting. So yeah, a group
Thank
of
you,
people,
Siri.
There is a group of people that are superior in their abilities and their qualities. And through that superiority, they have impact and influence on other people. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that definition is a little bit problematic because I think the context of our discussion is elites in society. I don't know.
Wait, does it have to do something with the wealth?
But sometimes you can say, like, this is a footballer, but this is an elite footballer, right? He's much, much better, right?
Yeah, of course, of course. You can always narrow it down, but then there's, like, general elite. People are just, like, elite in the world.
Would you consider yourself to be an elite, sister?
At home. For sure, I'm an elite at home. Or maybe in the extended family to a degree, but then it stops there because social
normally,
anxiety
like in
happens.
General, the rich people are considered to be elites, right?
Definitely, because they've got influence. You know, rich people, we should not underestimate the influence of the rich folks.
Mm-hmm.
They influence the politicians, they influence the pharmaceuticals, they influence the media, you know, they influence a freaking pandemic.
Yeah.
So that they could be more rich.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to Back to Reality after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
Azure dawning skies, I watch you bloom the birth of spring. You are the song that all others sing. You are the key holding me in.
Thank you so very much for joining us again on this show. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio with my special guests. How about elites in a religious context?
What is the term for elites in the Quran, man? I don't know why it's slipping my mind for the last 2 days.
Abrar? As-sabiqun?
No. In the negative context where they denied the elites of Nur society when the Anbiya came to them. Hold on.
Al-Mala?
Yes, I think
Mala?
So.
The affluent in the Quran, how does Allah refer to them?
It's always the elites of society who traditionally throughout history have been the ones to reject the prophets, right?
Yes, yes,
they've
yes.
always, and whenever the prophets came to a certain people, you'll notice that the quarrel has always been with the elites of that group. the people, generally speaking, are ready to accept, but unfortunately they are under the influence of the elites, and so the elites often misguide them. The elites have the power to misguide and guide the people.
Yeah. So that's the thing.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is, Brother Hassani?
Because the religion stops them, you know, with the work. It's like a barrier, like between them and the mission.
And their assets, their interests.
Yeah, and their assets. Like religion becomes a barrier. So the prophet, being the leader of the religion, that's the reason they used to oppose the prophets and all. So, like, you know, elites, the influential personalities, right? So now we have to look, is there any good influence or bad influence? But unfortunately, we usually get to see the negative or the bad influence.
Even during the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it was the elites of Quraysh that stood against him. It was the elites of Quraysh that opposed to his message and boycotted him in the Sha'b of Abi Talib for 3 years, because they felt that, wait, hold on a second, this man is coming and telling me that my slave is equal to me.
Yeah.
He's telling me that my woman is equal to me. I'm not the most superior creature that ever graced God's earth, you know?
And if I'm not wrong, I guess we can call Bibi Khadija elite as well. So that's what, like, we can see good influence and some bad influence.
Mm-hmm. And Abu Talib.
Yeah, Hazrat Abu Talib.
Definitely they were part of the elite.
Don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Thank you so very much for joining us again on this show. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio with my special guests.
So as we were mentioning, so Sayyidah Khadija salam alayha can be an elite, and Hadrat Abu Talib,
definitely, they're considered as elite. They're elite. The elite of the elite.
Now, what we can see that even there were some elites from Quraysh.
Mm-hmm.
So they used their wealth against the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But Sayyidah Khadija used her wealth for Islam. So, like, they're elites, like, they're good, like, they've got good influence. And similarly, the vice versa.
Yeah.
People use their wealth against Islam. But mostly what happens is, you know, their assets, their missions, you know, their goals, religion becomes a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, that's the reason they oppose Islam. They want to be the superior, and, like, there's nothing like equality or anything.
Yeah.
That's the reason they oppose Islam.
So Imam Khamenei has a beautiful discussion in this regard in Tarh Kulli, Outline of the Glorious Quran. Mm-hmm. And he says that, look, when it came to the mission of the prophets, you can summarize that as Tawheed, to bring about Tawheed, get rid of all the idols that exist in society. And he said the people were actually deceived. The general masses, they actually thought that these idols have power over them. Mm-hmm. However, the elites knew all too well that these idols are just creations of their own hands.
Oh, it reminds me of that scene from the series of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam.
So, the elites knew, and the reason that they would keep those idols alive and they would fight to defend those idols is because they created a cage through which they could actually imprison the masses.
Because
they had control over the minds of the
control,
masses.
Control, yes, exactly. Exactly. It's all about control, you know? It's all about the power, that reign they have over the masses.
Yeah, so if we take it to today's age, for example, the masses might believe in democracy.
But there is no such thing.
But the politicians don't believe in it themselves, right? They're using that idol of democracy to just control the masses. But otherwise, they're like, freedom? What does that mean to a politician? He's got everything, he's in control, he doesn't care, right? So it's very interesting that if we study Islam and the idea of elitism in Islam, it actually opens up our perspective of the world around us today.
If we go through the history of Islam, God has always used, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has used these elites for his own work, like for Islam. Like, you know, like Fir'aun. Like the miracle of Hadrat Musa alayhi salam, you know, it didn't occur like in a small place, you know, in front of a, like, you know, just a random dude. It took place in the palace of Fir'aun. Mm. So that the message of the Prophet spread across Egypt, the whole Egypt. So, you know, it took place at a big stage.
In front
you know,
of all the elites.
Yeah. Think about it. Were any of the prophets really like no name, layman, anonymous, ambiguous figures? Were they really? Even Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was literally one of the. He was the grandson of the chief of the greatest tribe in the Arabic Peninsula.
Yeah.
Nabi. Yahya alayhi salam, mm-hmm. Nabi Zakariya, Nabi Isa, renowned family of Bani Israel. Nabi Sha'ib, there's even a verse in the Quran about it. Nabi Dawood, Nabi Sulaiman, kings for crying out loud.
But like most of the, you know, prophets you're talking about, they're renowned because of the, you know, prophecy. Like, which is coming from
even
the ancestors.
No,
their
she's
prophethood.
Saying that they were, even before their prophethood.
They had tribal superiority during a time that factor mattered. I'm saying that, so it all comes down to the fact that this sort of superiority matters, right? It matters in terms of how far you can push your message.
Time of darkness and greed, it is your light that we need. You came to teach us how to live, Muhammad, Ya Rasulullah. You were so caring and kind, your soul was full of love.
Rasulullah, sure, he was an orphan. His grandfather was Abdul Muttalib, or like Hashim. They were really, really huge figures. His wife was Sayyidah Khadija. She was known as the Amira of Arabia, the princess, like the grand lady, the duchess of Arabia. And she had so much money that the equivalent of which perhaps does not exist in any degree now, today, for a woman at least, right? So this degree of influence, of power, of control really matters, because it's a tool, it's a means that we need to utilize if we really want to get a message across. Oh, that's why celebrities get stuff done. When a celebrity endorses something, everyone listens. Influence.
I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
What the U.S. did to Afghanistan and its people is not a series of mistakes or good intentions gone awry, but crimes. And there is still no end in sight, says Brian Terrell, writer, in an article titled, No, the longest war in U.S. history is not over. Stay tuned for more. Speaking from the White House on August 31st, President Joe Biden lied to the people of the U.S. and to the world, saying, Last night in Kabul, the United States ended 20 years of war in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history. The U.S. war on Afghanistan did not end. It has only adapted to technological advances and morphed into a war that will be more politically sustainable. One more intractable and more easily exportable. As the president admitted, we will maintain the fight against terrorism in Afghanistan and other countries. We just don't need to fight a ground war to do it. We have what's called over-the-horizon capabilities, which means we can strike terrorists and targets without American boots on the ground or very few if needed. Unquote. 5 days before, on the evening of Thursday, August 26, hours after a suicide bomb was detonated at the gate of Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport, killing and wounding scores of Afghans trying to flee their country and killing 18 U.S. troops, President Biden spoke to the world saying, outraged as well as heartbroken. Many of us listening to the president's speech made before the victims could be counted and the rubble cleared did not find comfort or hope in his words. Instead, our heartbreak and outrage were only amplified as Joe Biden seized the tragedy to call for more war. Biden threatened to those who carried out the attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive, we will not forget, we will hunt you down and make you pay, adding, I've also ordered my commanders to develop operational plans to strike ISIS-K assets, leadership, and facilities. We will respond with force and precision at our time, at the place we choose in the moment of our choosing, unquote. The president's threatened moment of our choosing came one day later on Friday, August 27th, when the U.S. military carried out a drone strike against what it said was an ISIS-K planner in Afghanistan's eastern Nangarhar province. The U.S. military's claim that it knows of no civilian casualties in the attack is considered by reports from the ground. We saw that rickshaws were burning, one Afghan witness said, adding, children and women were wounded and one man, one boy, and one woman had been killed on the spot. Fear of an ISIS-K counterattack further hampered evacuation efforts as the U.S. Embassy warned U.S. citizens to leave the airport. President Biden said this strike was not the last. On August 29th, another U.S. drone strike killed a family of 10 in Kabul. The first lethal drone strike in history occurred in Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, when the CIA identified Taliban leader Mullah Omar, or 98% probable it was he. But the Hellfire missile launched by a Predator drone killed two unidentified men, while Mullah Omar escaped. These two recent instances of force and precision ordered by Biden 20 years later marked the presumed end to the war. There was just as it had begun. The intervening record has not been much better, and in fact, documents exposed by the whistleblower Daniel Hale prove that. U.S. government is aware that 90% of its drone strike victims are not the intended targets. Zamari Ahmadi, who was killed on August 29th drone strike in Kabul, along with nine members of his family, seven of them young children, had been employed by a California-based humanitarian organization and had applied for a visa to come to the U.S., as had Ahmadi's nephew, Nasser, also killed in the same attack. Nasser had worked with U.S. Special Forces in the Afghan city of Herat and had also served as a guard for the U.S. consulate there. Whatever affinity the surviving members of Ahmadi family and friends might have had with the U.S. went up in the smoke that day. America is the killer of Muslims in every place and every time, said one relative who attended the funeral, adding, I hope that all Islamic countries unite in their view that America is a criminal. Another mourner, a colleague of Ahmadi, said, we are now much more afraid of drones than we are of the Taliban. The fact that targeted killings like those carried out in Afghanistan and other places from 2001 to the present are counterproductive to the stated objectives of defeating terrorism, regional stability, or a winning hearts and minds has been known by the architects of the so-called War on Terror, at least since 2009. Thanks to WikiLeaks, we have access to a CIA document from that year making high-value targeting operations an effective counterinsurgency tool. Among the key findings in the CIA report, analysts warn of the negative consequences of assassinating so-called high-level targets, HLT. The potential negative effect of HLT operations include increasing the level of insurgent support, strengthening an armed group's bonds with the population, radicalizing an insurgent group's remaining leaders, creating a vacuum into which more radical groups can enter, and escalating or de-escalating a conflict in ways that favor the insurgents. The obvious truth that the CIA kept buried in a secret report have been admitted many times by high-ranking officers implementing those policies. In 2013, General James E. Cartwright, former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, reported in New York Times, we're seeing that blowback. If you're trying to kill your way to a solution, no matter how precise you are, you're going to upset people even if they're not targeted. In a 2010 interview in Rolling Stone, General Stanley McChrystal, then commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, figured that for every innocent person you kill, you create 10 new enemies. By the general's equation, the U.S. created a minimum of 130 new enemies for itself in the strikes ordered by President Biden on August 27th and 29th alone. When the catastrophic consequences of a nation's policies are so clearly predictable and evidently inevitable, they are intentional. What has happened to Afghanistan is not a series of mistakes or good intentions, gone awry. They are crimes. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange noted that these dire predictions had come to pass, speaking in 2011. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the US and Europe through Afghanistan and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. The goal is an endless war, not a successful war. No, the war is not over. From a nation that should be promising reparations and begging the forgiveness of the people of Afghanistan comes the infantile raging. We will not forgive, we will not forget. In the simplistic dualism of U.S. partisan politics, the issue seems to be only whether the current president should be blamed or should be given a pass and the blame put on his predecessor. This is a discussion that is not only irrelevant, but a dangerous evasion of responsibility. 20 years of war crimes makes many complicit.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.